Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks, and this is part two in our series, Stop Procrastinating Now, or soon. And some of you might be saying, wow, Brett, you're really cute and creative when it comes to your titles. How do you do it? Now, of course, I appreciate your compliments and your questions. There's something else here. The title has a bit of a hidden meaning, and if you know what it is, you've already learned one of the most important lessons in today's show. So let's talk about where we left things off last time. We're talking about worry and how it affects productivity, or how it essentially creates a procrastinator's mindset. And I want to finish up with that, some ways to dispute and evaluate destructive forms of thinking and to turn them into rational action. And then we'll progress into more episodes about types of procrastination so you can better diagnose yourself if this is something you think you need to work on. And, of course, finally, the solutions. But it's really important for me to start with this root of procrastination, and that's what we're going to continue to work on today. Let's do it.
Verb is a word, it's an action word. If you can do it, then you do it. If you do it, it's a verb. A verb is a word, it's an action word. If you can do it, then you do it. If you do it, it's a verb. Listen up close, here's what we'll do. I'll say a verb and you say it too. Now when we're playing, when you say it, I want you to do it too. Alright, now everybody, get ready. Because the first verb we're gonna do is clap.
So in the first show, we talked about how we can minimize the amount of worry, the amount of anxiety that's playing in the background of our minds if we deal with the triggers more actively and more constructively when they first occur, as what I referred to in that ABC tool as activating events. But before we revisit that, I want to make sure that we have the best map for dealing with worry, anxiety, and subsequent diminished productivity or procrastination. So whatever the issues are that we might face as individuals, rational emotive therapy tries to get at the core through three general techniques. The first one, thinking techniques. The second one, emotional techniques. And the third, behavioral techniques. And today on the show, we'll go through all three and give some examples. So let's start with thinking techniques. ABC, what I went through in the last show, continues beyond the C and actually goes a little further into the alphabet. And it's the two steps that follow A, B, and C that actually make it a helpful tool. So let's review a little bit first. First, we have A, an activating event, an agitation, or some form of adversity. And then we have a belief about it. The belief could be rational in the forms of wants or wishes, or the belief could be irrational in the form of shoulds, musts, other types of demands. And whether the beliefs are rational or irrational, they have consequences. I know that a lot of the irrational beliefs that I've had about activating events in the past go way back into my history as a human on this planet. You know, those psychodynamic factors that we talked about in the first show. Deeply ingrained thinking patterns, maybe feeling patterns would be more appropriate. Things that I've definitely tried to deal with. And in some cases, I've done well, and in some cases, I'm still working. And I think people out there can identify with that. But I was programmed a certain way by the experiences that I had early in life, by the experiences that I had in school, by the experiences that I had social, familial, etc. Anything that we learn that goes against our programming, or anything that we want to do that goes against our programming, requires a conscious maintenance. Or I think it's very easy to revert back to the original wiring, the original programming. Because that thinking, those irrational beliefs, if we don't slow down after some kind of activating event occurs, they just go forward and they kind of collect into this vague worry or uneasiness. So fortunately, what I introduced last week as this ABC tool will today become an ABCDE tool. The D is the discovering and then the disputation of dysfunctional beliefs. And this can be done by taking those things that are identified as irrational and turning them into questions and answers. So when we're faced with an activating event, a trigger, and we have beliefs, and those beliefs, if we pause or slow down and try to inventory what they are, we need to dispute them, basically using the scientific method. Okay, well, I think this, or I feel this. Well, let's find the proof. And if we don't do that, see, this is like where worry and absence of productivity seem to come from, at least in my experience. Our thinking can just run on, unevaluated, until we wind up in some very bad places. So whenever I find a should, a must, even like a self-rating, I'm bad, I'm ineffective, whenever I'm dealing in absolutes, all that stuff needs to go. That's all part of the disputation process. I don't want to rate myself as a person. I'm good or bad, right? I do things that are good. I do things that are bad. And I guess I do things that are neutral. And the action or lack of action is the thing that can be evaluated. Ellis talks about defining ourselves in terms of things that can't be disputed. I did this. I did not do this. Instead of saying I am always this, or I am bad. And the result is E, some form of effective new thinking. For effective new thinking, Ellis even suggests writing out coping statements and going over them a few times. With respect to this performance anxiety that we discussed, saying something like, I don't have to do well. It's not that I must do well. Doing well would be preferable. I can cope with stressors and adversity in my environment, and usually do well. Maybe not always, but usually do well. Statements that don't have judgments, shoulds, musts, or absolutes in them. Now, we've talked a lot on the show in the past about knee-jerk reactions versus thoughtful responses. We've also used that computer model of input, process, output, where the process is the thinking about whatever the input or activating event is. So in this case, we're not talking about adversity necessarily. There's some new current event. I remember the first time I talked about this on the show was after the supposed assassination of Osama bin Laden. If you're too young to remember, hopefully we have people in the audience who are too young to maybe remember this. But in 2011, May, I think, Obama gets up and he gives a speech where he basically says, yeah, we got some actionable intelligence about the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden. We sent this elite group called SEAL Team 6. And that sounds like something out of a Hollywood movie, and soon it will be. So, you know, check your local theater listings. And they killed bin Laden. 10-minute speech, over 100 logical fallacies, no evidence presented. They dumped the body in the ocean. And like an hour later, people were doing the Pledge of Allegiance at Ground Zero. Not a lot of processing evident there. I'll never forget the day I was listening to Rush Limbaugh, and one of there was a rare caller who was taking issue with something that he said, and the caller had the audacity to say on the air, well, I really encourage your listeners to do their own research. And Rush Limbaugh snapped at him and said, no, my listeners don't need to do their own research. That's what I'm for. Rarely are people in the mainstream media, even though Rush Limbaugh would consider himself in some kind of renegade alternative media, but rarely do people who exist and work within that safe box of mainstream political thinking, be they Rush Limbaugh or whoever supports Obama, rarely are they so honest, even by accident, about what that form of media is all about. You don't need to do your own processing. Here are your inputs. And oh, we even have suggested outputs, right? Here are the activating events. Here are the unproductive, disempowering emotional consequences that we recommend as follow-ups. So for most people, through schooling and through the consumption of mainstream media, we are conditioned to be input-output. AC machines, activating event, consequence, activating event, consequence, action carrot, action stick. So let's think of some polarizing issues in current events lately. The Eric Gardner, the Ferguson, and the fallout from all of that. You know, so those things happen and people say, I'm angry. What are the available ways I can feel about this? What are the reactions? So it seemed like it boiled down to, and feel free to write in if you disagree, that the two positions available were pro-black and pro-cop. So the mainstream media consumers looked at the two available choices and they said, many of them said anyway, oh, well, that's how I feel. Has anyone prepared some chants? Yes. If you decided to be pro-black, first of all, on behalf of the mainstream media and the politicians, congratulations. That is super unproductive and divisive. Us versus them. We love that kind of stuff. So we've got hands up, don't shoot. We've got I can't breathe. Or, of course, we've got Black Lives Matter. Just make sure that your position is expressed in unison with hundreds of other people over and over again. Or if pro-black is too radical for you, it's got like kind of a dirty 60s vibe that you don't like, hey, how about pro-cop? Because what better a time to be blindly pro-cop in the middle of an ever-expanding police state? But those are the emotional consequences of these activating events that we suggest, because they both invite you to skip over learning about or processing anything of actual importance or relevance or anything that's constructive. Oh, but wait, I'm being kind of a hypocrite right now, because as liberty-minded people, it's so easy for us to look at this scene in the mainstream media and go, ha ha, idiots. But I still catch myself doing AC input-output in my own head pretty frequently. In the last show, I talked about the man in the convenience store who's in front of me, and he's buying scratch tickets for too long. And this is not one man. This is every man in front of me in convenience stores. You know, maybe it's not. Maybe something happens to my mind when I go into convenience stores, because there's other stereotypes as well. I swore for a long time that I had this formula that, and I dared people in my personal life to prove me wrong. The formula was man of Middle Eastern or Indian origin plus waiting on me in a convenience store equals talking on the phone. You know, I'll double down on that. Prove me wrong. But this is not Scratch Ticket Man. There's no judgment there. There's no resentment there. In fact, when I go into a convenience store and I have this experience, it makes me happy. I feel vindicated. I feel like a scientist. Sir, you are Pakistani, and you agree that you are waiting on me here, like I'm giving you money for a product that I found in your store. I also see that you're on the phone. Well, congratulations to me. Anyway, my girlfriend Allie was listening to that part of the show, you know, Scratch Ticket Man. She pointed out to me that that was activating event consequence, the way I described it. Now, there's an opportunity there for quite a bit of processing. Am I really mad at Scratch Ticket Man? Do I want to be angry? And if the answers are no and no, then why am I bothered by this? And what are the residuals of that negative emotional experience, even if it only lasts for 45 seconds to a minute? What's my attitude like after leaving the convenience store? All worth considering. So I started to think about it. I am frustrated because I'm behind this man because I feel like I'm in a rush, right? That's what the feeling is for me. I'm in a rush. I don't have enough time. Why do I feel like that? And if I start to identify what's behind this perpetual feeling, being rushed, not having enough time, I'm on the path to effective new thinking. And one of the identified roots of that gnawing feeling is this demand that I must get more done, or I'm not getting enough done. And it's tied to these comparisons that I do between myself and other media producers. Now, that's my issue to work on. I don't need to be sighing and toe-tapping all over the dreams of some poor man who doesn't have a comprehensive understanding of the unfavorable odds on $2 scratch tickets. So this first thinking exercise, A, B, C, D, really, really ties in with the first pillar of self-esteem, as identified by Nathaniel Brandon, living consciously. Asking ourselves the question, how am I feeling right now? Am I worried? Do I feel unproductive? Am I experiencing performance anxiety about something that I know needs to be done in the near future? The consequences of that, we know, lack of productivity, procrastination. Of course, it can be expanded way beyond that to whatever situation we find troubling or frustrating at a given time. What do we believe about it? Identify those beliefs. Maybe some are constructive, maybe some are toxic. Dispute the toxic beliefs using the scientific method, trying to prove them wrong, and trying to develop actionable new thinking. But there's other thinking techniques we can use to help us combat worry, anxiety, procrastination. And one of the most effective ones for me is what I would describe as mentoring, modeling. Last summer, I went and I stayed with Richard Grove from Tragedy and Hope for like 3+ months. Rich and Lisa really had their acts together, and it was a tremendous learning experience. Because I always admired his commitment, his focus, his attention to detail. And even though you might not hear from Tragedy and Hope every week, when you hear from them, it counts. And I also found him to be like very composed. He didn't get flustered. Every problem was just seen as an opportunity to develop a solution. But we live in a time where people are lining up to be models for us. Tim Ferriss, his website is great. David Allen. There's a lot of things I like about the philosophy of life of somebody like Joe Rogan. He's dropped more than one ball politically, philosophically, but there's lots of things about, you know, his approach to life that I really admire. So this modeling mentoring can be really beneficial, but it has to work in tandem with other thinking techniques like the evaluation of beliefs. Because when we find people that we admire, or when I find people that I admire, it's very easy to get sucked into this kind of thinking like, why not me? Why can't I do that? I must be more like that. But I mustn't. It's not true. Like some of the people that I would compare myself to, well, maybe they've been at it longer. Maybe they have more resources. Maybe they have higher IQs. So I don't like the idea of looking up to people. I like the idea of looking into people in appropriate, you know, and respectful ways. And some people, especially people producing media, make that fairly easy to do. Tim Ferriss, great example of that, very open and vulnerable. There's James Altucher, entrepreneur and venture capitalist, who does his own show and really has like a candidness about his own failures that I really enjoy. So related to this, one thing, I mentioned this when I was talking about Richard Grove, another thinking technique where he was really adept was reframing. Seeing potential stressors as maybe even exciting new challenges in search of tools that we might already have. And because of that, the recognition that a lot of these things are quite temporary. Modeling is also something that we can do through teaching others. I look at the work of Albert Ellis. I take some notes, and I've got actually, you know, this notebook from 2011 when I was first learning about this stuff, and I've turned it into my own words and thoughts, and I've made it useful in my own life in many ways, not in every way, but in many ways, and I want to share it with other people. I've got written right here. This is October 14th, 2012. I wrote, "You should only be facing discomfort when it is actionable, and always when it is actionable." Damn, that's some sage advice from past me, the future aspiring stoic. And because these are thinking techniques to deal with an issue, let's bring critical thinking into it. Semantic precision, identification, proper definition, grammar. One of the reasons why we worry so much is because of messy thinking. And a lot of messy thinking can be the result of messy talking. We all understand, as I've said before, we all understand how our thoughts become our words, but our words become our thoughts. If you talk about government and you use the word we, you develop a sympathetic and even defensive attitude about the government. In your personal life, if you say, "Oh, I'm never going to be able to do that," what are the thoughts that follow? Before we can reframe the thing I talked about admiring in Rich's thinking, we have to properly identify problems. And A, B, C, D, E is really helpful with that. So if we can eliminate unknowns through what Ellis often refers to as semantic precision, what we would call clear definition, we're on the path to better thinking. It's very easy to become worried and fearful about the unknown. And those worries and fears, as far as productivity is concerned, can lead to procrastination. So let's bring in getting things done, what we discussed in our Presence and Productivity series. How many times have you heard people say, or how many times have you said yourself, "Ah, I got a project"? That's very daunting. A project? Who knows how many steps or actions are involved in that? You can't do projects, as David Allen says. You can only do actions. So identify what the actions are that need to be done. Then you can do them. So the five stages of getting things done, as outlined in the book by the same name: 1, collect; 2, process; 3, organize; 4, review; and 5, do. You turn projects into lists of individual actions. You identify what needs to be done. Okay, part 2, emotional techniques for minimizing worry, anxiety, and procrastination. First and foremost, the Stoic practice of negative visualization. A quick definition from the blog Getting Stronger. Simply put, imagining the worst, contemplating the loss of one's friends, loved ones, and dearest possessions. And to that, I want to add, I just want to jump in and relate this to productivity, imagining failure, imagining mediocre outcomes. So I'm testing that right now. I feel like I've gone through this process of visualizing thousands and thousands and thousands of people listening to me eat shit in this episode. Today is Monday. It is 4:37 p.m. Eastern time right now. I am releasing this episode on Tuesday the 20th, no matter what. That is typically not how I work with deadlines. I don't like that. If I decide I wanted to put way more thought into something, re-record something, I like to have the freedom to do that. But not this time. I'm kind of excited to see what happens. Back to the definition. Imagining the worst, contemplating the loss of one's friends, loved ones, and dearest possessions, in order to foster a greater appreciation for what one already has. William Irvine, who is the author of a book called Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy, noted that Stoics observed how people naturally tend to take for granted what they already have and have a strong tendency to continually seek new possessions or sources of happiness. He calls this hedonic adaptation and discusses the value of negative visualization as an antidote to it. And there's a side benefit here. By contemplating the worst, by identifying these fears, we can immunize ourselves, not necessarily from the dangers of what I would say is positive thinking. I think positive thinking is a very healthy practice. But a lot of times, positive thinking is a misnomer for not thinking carefully or completely enough, failing to do a realistic accounting of the world around us. So negative visualization needs to have outcomes aside from just being like a real downer. I learned this the hard way. I mean, I've had situations, like especially with family, where people were talking about some issue and then I walked into the room and they wanted to change the subject immediately because my viewpoint was too grim. And I'm not blaming them. I'm taking responsibility. They had learned by observing my past strategies that I didn't seem to have a non-judgmental, non-jerk-offy way of talking about whatever that issue was. And that's actually really unfortunate that I didn't have better strategies, because I feel like in many cases, in many of those subjects, I was the one with the most realistic accounting of the world around us. But unfortunately, whatever the message was fell on deaf ears. So we don't want to become downers. What we want out of it is, first of all, this realistic accounting that I spoke of, this preparation, this immunization. But most importantly, we also want gratitude. And gratitude is one of the keys to not only worrying less, experiencing less anxiety, but in my opinion, from my experience, it's also one of the keys to being more productive. So here is a practical strategy for increased productivity, one that incorporates gratitude. And I should also point out that all of these thinking techniques, behavioral techniques, and emotional techniques, there's some interplay between the three, and this is an example of that. So in other words, just to be super clear here, I want to have emotional techniques for building gratitude, but those need to be enhanced by thinking and behavioral techniques, actual practices. So I keep a record of everything that I do, how every working hour of the day is spent. Now, I've talked on the show before about how to-do lists and calendars are not, at least historically for me, effective tools on their own for productivity and organization. So it wasn't until I had the foundation of the getting things done method, which was totally enhanced by the software program that I promoted several times called Evernote. Wasn't until I had that foundation that I saw how calendars and to-do lists could actually be useful if integrated into a more comprehensive system. So every day a to-do list is written and every day is organized on a calendar. This adds up to maybe 10 minutes of time. And some people, we're all different. Some people might say, well, doing those things is a waste of time for me because I have some other system. Great. It provides me a kind of calm and clarity that I don't have otherwise. And these methods of record keeping later function as what I would describe as gratitude lists. So now everything is tracked in Evernote. Evernote is great for being able to see the horizontal view of your life, which is all the things you have going on at once, but to also be able to see the vertical view of your life, all the elements of each thing, right? So horizontal goes across life and vertical goes down into detail of every project, pursuit, goal, every activity, etc. Now, if you use Evernote, and I'm going to go off course a little bit to provide some detail here. So I hope that's okay. I know a lot of people in the audience have started using Evernote or used it before we talked about it, and that's great. I just want to talk a little bit about some of my organization. I have an inbox, which is also labeled stuff. Anytime something new comes in that I want to capture and hold on to, it goes there. And it can just sit there for a day. That's fine. I have another folder called Next Actions, and these are actually notebook stacks that can contain multiple folders. So inside of Next Actions, I have a folder called Completed Daily Action Lists, this month, this week, and today. So every day in today, a to-do list is created of actions from projects or unrelated things. Get new car battery. I have another notebook stack called goals, personal goals this month, personal goals this year, personal goals for 5 years, SSP goals for 5 years, this month, this year. Then I have something called current projects, which is everything that's going on right now, a series called success stories, a procrastination series, scientific consensus versus dissent series with Daryl Becker, which you have not heard yet, but is already in progress. And this other project that I got sucked into called The Six Functions of Secondary School, and I don't know what the future of that is. I have another notebook stack called Current on Hold, projects that are still open, but I'm not working on right now. Improving the website, increasing my income, autonomy through agorism, the John Taylor Gatto video series, and there's a few others that wouldn't make any sense to you. But I can stop there. I have other notebook stacks, personal pursuits, incubation, things that are totally on hold and I'm not thinking about or haven't started. Reference, which includes like spreadsheets, School Sucks art, things related to the site, stock video footage. And then I have a notebook stack called Things Done, which is every project or every action that I've completed since I started using Evernote. The calendar, because now I use the calendar, has records of what I did every hour I spent working going back months. Now we're talking about the interplay between thinking techniques, emotional techniques, and behavioral techniques. So let's say I have an emotion in need of dispute. I'm not effective. I never get anything done. Well, I don't want to judge myself so absolutely like that. I am not this. I only want to evaluate myself using things that are not open for disputation. I did these things or I did not do these things. So if I feel that way, I never get anything done. Every time I look at my calendar, every time I look at Evernote, every time that I look at the to-do list for that day, I see a record of actions that prove me wrong. You know, seemingly endless lists of achievements for which I should be somewhat grateful. I was talking to my friend John just the other day, and he asked this question, kind of rhetorically. But I liked it so much, I turned it into a note in Evernote, and it's still sitting in my inbox. It really should be moved to the Procrastination Series folder. We will do that right now. He said, what comes first, motivation or action? I think the answer, for me anyway, has to be action. And the accumulation of actions done helps us dispute the attitudes that result in procrastination. It contributes to our motivation. But not for me anyway, if I just said, I've done a lot of stuff in my life. I want that stuff identified. I need to get better at writing notes too, because also in this note it says 2-minute rule, but still record it. I don't know what the fuck that means, but I want to make it useful because I've said it. The 2-minute rule, for those of you who don't know, if something comes into your work world and it can be dealt with in less than 2 minutes, just do it. Now, I've gotten into this habit because I want to keep records of things to dispute this notion that I'm ineffective when that notion happens. So even if something only takes 2 minutes, I still make it a to-do item and I still check it off when it's done. So I've got, I said this to Bill Buport. If someone says to me, what did you do on your birthday this year? I have records, folks. I click the notebook stack, next actions. I open the folder, complete a daily action list. Scroll, 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 8/7/14. Well, I had a meeting. I did an interview with Kevin Geary. I drove to Kittery to have dinner. I called my brother. I sent an email to Joby Weeks. I added some code to the website relating to Amazon links. I took my vitamins and I went to the gym. Happy birthday. That feels good to me. You know, maybe you're listening to this and you're like, Brett, whatever, cool story, okay? I procrastinate because I like Pinterest more than my job. So when my job feels extra sucky, I open Pinterest. That's my problem. But next week, my work is going to block Pinterest, so then I'll be fine. I don't know. It's my show. I'm telling you my stories. So let's move on, but let's review first. We were talking about emotional techniques related to rational emotive behavior therapy for combating worry, anxiety, and subsequent diminished productivity, i.e. procrastination. I talked about what Ellis calls this rational emotive imagery, or what Stoics call negative visualization, really getting in touch with your most troubling discomforts and getting involved in the emotions of that, and not saying, yeah, that's okay. Because when you're imagining bad things, Ellis points out, you shouldn't feel okay. What do you tell yourself about these worst case scenarios? And he tells people to practice this imagery for like 3-4 weeks in a row and see what kind of results you get. Before we move on, it's also worth pointing out that the first thing that we talked about in the show today, which I summed up under thinking techniques, really, really relates to the first pillar of self-esteem, living consciously. But these emotional techniques really tie in nicely with the second pillar of self-esteem, self-acceptance. The negative visualization relates to this as well. It's a willingness to actually experience rather than disown the facts of our being. You can let go of negative feelings by acknowledging them without liking them. Because if we don't accept ourselves, we are putting all kinds of distance between our real conscious thoughts and our needs, feelings, frustrations. And we wind up with this very dangerous obliviousness to ourselves. I'm really enjoying the way this is coming together. I hope you are too. So let's move on to the third and final category in today's show, behavioral techniques or practices. I wanted to share some of my own experiences, if that's okay. Like I mentioned before, I was introduced to the work of Albert Ellis and rational emotive behavior therapy around 2011. But what I found to be one of the more valuable practices, I did at first completely by accident and over a considerable period of time. But it was perfect timing because I had just decided to quit doing School Sucks podcast. I figured if we had done like 708 episodes, I was like, this has run its course. So, all right, bye. One of the experiences that I had that changed my mind and contributed to re-motivating me, many people would probably describe as one of the stupidest and most seemingly pointless activities I was ever involved in. It was a podcast called Wheels Off Liberty. So here's the story. In 2009, I started the podcast, the School Sucks podcast. Now, the format and the presentation was that I was an adult, a former teacher, and I was talking to, hopefully, high school kids. And you can certainly hear that in the presentation of the very, very early shows. So October, November 2009, I get invited on Stefan Molyneux's Free Domain Radio show. In the next week, I watch our audience. I mean, we were a typical podcast at the time, 7 or 8 episodes in the can, 100 listeners. Within a week, there were 1,000 people listening to the show on a regular basis, and I kind of had to face the fact that 9 out of 10 people in my audience came from Free Domain Radio. And obviously, the standards of the Free Domain Radio audience, as far as consuming a podcast, they're very high. And at the end of that year, we started advertising on Free Talk Live, and our audience size like doubled from there. Now, at the time, and looking back, I'm very grateful that all of this happened. But when it happened, I really wasn't prepared on a personal level to deal with it. And that translated to the show. And here's what I mean. I realized that the whole presentation, for me anyway, looking back, I don't think I realized all of this at the time, had become kind of constrained by what my idea of the audience was. And this irrational and at the time unquestioned belief that I had to somehow please everybody. And the result was I wasn't expressing myself properly and I wasn't expressing myself authentically. And even if I wasn't completely cognizant of all of that, it definitely diminished my motivation for doing the show. And I quit. And at the time, I was listening to this podcast called Red Bar Radio. It's a comedy show for most of you. I don't recommend it. And I was really inspired by this comeback that the show did. The show was essentially sabotaged. The main host had some untrustworthy people working with him, and they basically took over the show, shut down his website. It seemed like it was out of spite. It's a long story. But in the end of 2011, he brought the show back, and it was bigger and better than ever. And I was listening more closely, and I observed, this guy just does whatever he wants, as far as content is concerned. He does what makes him happy. What if I did that? And I started reflecting on this experience that I had had earlier, or actually pretty much all throughout 2011, of doing this Wheels Off Liberty comedy, quote-unquote, podcast. And I said, that's like the best experience. That's the most fun I've had doing this. So if my show can be useful educationally, and it had a decent reputation at the time for being fairly useful educationally, can I bring more of that freedom to it? Can I face this fear of not pleasing everybody and then act in defiance of that fear? Albert Ellis calls this a shame attacking exercise. I remember being so overly concerned with the disapproval of other people that, at least in what showed up in the audio recordings, I had become somebody else. And again, this was really just like something I was unprepared for. The eyes and ears of thousands of people. It definitely didn't translate to my social life, my personal life, always like seeking approval of other people. But suddenly I felt like that chubby middle school kid again, cautiously walking through the halls, worried what everyone is thinking. What's the Free Domain audience going to think? What's the Free Talk Live audience going to think? What are the Ron Paul people going to think? How do you talk to Christian minarchists and the Free Domain audience at the same time? These are things that I thought about. But through finding more opportunities to be, dare I say, idiotic, I got more comfortable just doing exactly what I want to do on the show. And it saved the show. And then the show was monetized, the website was rebuilt, we reached more people than we had ever reached before, even with those two great bumps from those two great shows. And I really believe that last year, 2014, 2 or 3 years after all this happened, was our best year of content. And there might be some people who say, oh, I actually thought it was the worst. But to me, it was the best. And I'm the guy whose, you know, satisfaction and motivation is required to keep the show going. So there's a story, you know. Another behavioral technique, journaling. Whenever you have one of these worry-inspiring, self-defeating, productivity-limiting kind of ideas, write it down and look at it on paper. This is great. This is a great thing to do if you're in therapy. I remember when I used to see this guy for therapy, he would have me do this. I would go home and I would write. Well, I was a kid. I was like 21. I would go home and I would write. And we'd bring the stuff back in and he would act as this enlightened witness. And we would talk about the things I wrote. Even better, it's so easy to do now with your phone or with Evernote or Audacity. Record yourself having these ideas when you have them. And listen back to them. Keep records of this stuff. Ellis used to do these role plays where somebody would bring up an issue that they had, and then they would pass that issue, this worry, this self-defeating idea, to a friend or somebody else participating in the exercise, and the other person would have to take that position, and the originator of the position or thought or feeling would have to argue against it. So it's like a way of looking at your own irrationality in the mirror and then processing it and disputing it. Very uncomfortable. So the behavioral techniques are really about doing things you're initially afraid to do. To do those things repeatedly. To make yourself uncomfortable. To take behavioral and emotional risks. And the things I mentioned can also be related pretty well to the third and fourth pillars of self-esteem. The third one is self-responsibility. By challenging ourselves through these behavioral techniques, we can reinforce the idea that we are response-able, able to respond to the challenges of life, that we don't have to be victims of other people's disapproval or victims of our own fears. Doing things that scare us, doing things that make us uncomfortable, also reinforce this idea that we are the chief causal agents in our lives and in our behaviors. We can take actions and then accept the consequences of those actions, which is certainly more empowering than reluctance and a mind filled with what-ifs and other fears. And that segues so nicely into the practice of self-assertiveness. The opposite of this practice is surrender to that apprehension, to that worry, to feel like we need to belong to a group and fit in to please others, to be good. In that self-esteem show, the one on self-assertiveness, I said something like, when we're young, we're taught that what we think and what we want are not important. And so it's very easy to grow up with a pretty underdeveloped sense of personal identity. And because of that, there's these worries, these apprehensions of what happens if I express myself? What happens if I affirm myself? What are people going to think if I appear to be too happy with myself and I stand out? And a lot of people become spectators instead of actors. So self-assertiveness and really the desired outcome of these behavioral techniques in rational emotive behavior therapy are all about the confronting of challenges, the striving for self-mastery, the expanding of our boundaries, the willingness to venture into unfamiliar or scary places, and the perseverance through all of those things. So, oh boy, look at the time. I am out of time. I hope you found these to be helpful techniques and practices for less worry and more action. And from here, we will move beyond this all-important root of procrastination into shows that deal specifically with that everyday practice of not getting shit done and what to do about it. The next show will be a relatively short one where we'll all get to figure out what style of procrastination we prefer. And there will probably be an episode or two after that as well. So, hey, I really look forward to your feedback. I appreciate what has come in so far. But if you have questions or specific issues that you want addressed in this series, please post in our Facebook group or contact me directly through the website. Thanks so much for listening, everybody, and take care. I was soups on the yard, now I'm on the inside, waiting for waving that feeling kind of untied, betting on a begging cow, fading in the sunshine. I was soups on the yard, now I'm on the inside. I was soups out of place, now I'm on the inside, falling out of outer space, swimming at land. I'm looking towards palace, it's fading in the sunshine. I was soups out of place, now I'm on the inside. Never really born, I was soon sleep.